For 3 months, the world had heard nothing about Michael Scott Moore, who had gone to investigate Somali piracy. And then this tape appeared on the internet.
I arrived here January 6th in Somalia. I came to write about the condition of the Somali people and about piracy in general.
What are you feeling outside of life?
I'm afraid. I'm terrified.
Okay, then what are you requesting for your government?
I have to request from the American or the German government the full ransom. They need to give an answer within 3 days. And if the ransom, if there's no answer to payment of the ransom within 3 days, then the kidnappers here will sell me to. Will sell me to Al-Shabaab. So these kidnappers here were related to 9 Somalis who were killed in action by U.S. troops.
Well, how is your life then?
My life is terrible. My life is terrible.
The pirates wanted $20 million. And that group he mentioned, Al-Shabaab, they're the sort of group that beheads journalists in order to make a point. This podcast today is going to be intense. Michael eventually made it out, but his story is harrowing as it is fascinating, as it is telling about the politics of the region today. So let's get into it. Back in 2011, the journalist and author Michael Scott Moore sent me an email about his impending visit to Somalia after he'd read an article that I did in Wired about the pirate business model. I didn't think that my advice in the end ended up being really helpful or useful at all. After all, I did my reporting by calling pirates on their satellite phones and talking to them at a very remote and safe distance. But like many journalists before him, Moore actually went to Somalia. And shortly thereafter, he was kidnapped and held hostage. He spent 977 days in captivity, and in that time he suffered psychological and physical abuse. And he was even present for a rescue attempt by special forces who freed other hostages in his compound, but left him behind. Later, his abductors threatened to sell him to the fundamentalist group Al-Shabaab, who have a history of executing their captives on video. In fact, the next time that I heard about Moore, which is, you know, just a little while later, was when I saw a ransom video on YouTube that his abductors had posted as, I guess you could call it, like a sort of advertisement that would raise his value on the international market. His account of his ordeal is in his book, The Desert and the Sea, and I highly recommend that you check it out. In fact, what you should do is you should go download the free sample on Kindle right now and then get totally hooked, and then go all the way in. And so with that introduction out of the way, Michael Scott Moore, thank you so much for being here. And, you know, let's just get right into it. What sent you there in the first place?
Well, it was not for lack of preparation. So I had covered a pirate trial in Hamburg for about a year for Spiegel Online. It was a historical trial of people have forgotten at this distance how new pirates were. They were a new old, you know, criminal phenomenon that we thought had been eradicated more or less for the last 200 years. And all of a sudden, there was this eruption of a real pirate threat off the coast of Somalia. And so for the first time in 400 years, there were 10 pirates in front of a German judge. So that was history, you know, reviving. And so I was fascinated by that, and I followed the trial for about a year, and by then I had already made a connection with another journalist named Ashwin Raman, an Indian-born man who did documentaries from Germany, and had been in and out of Afghanistan, in and out of Iraq, in and out of Somalia, and we both had an interest in doing something about this story, or something about pirates in general. And through the trial, I got pretty good connections to go to Somalia. So it began to seem not impossible. And by the way, we went along a path in central Somalia that was sort of a beaten path for a journalist. So we weren't trying to do anything all that new. The New York Times correspondent, Jeffrey Gettleman, had been along that path too and come back with a really good interview from a pirate named Mohammed Garfanji, who turned out to be the pirate boss in my case. So in other words, I met that guy. And he's still at large, by the way. He's still, if not a pirate kingpin, then a what you call a warlord. A warlord in Somalia is just a businessman with gunmen. And that's how you put your interests forward in a chaotic place, and not to say anarchic place like Somalia.
I mean, that's a great way to describe him, because I've met a couple warlords in other areas too, and they are people trying to make a buck in a lawless environment, and that requires, doing things that secure you with arms, and that easily puts you into sort of a business model idea. And, you phrase it really nicely, like piracy, for all intents and purposes, when we think of pirates, we think Captain Jack Sparrow, right? We think of a guy with an eye patch and a parrot, and the Barbary Wars and things that are, seems in our distant past. But piracy has really become a new phenomenon. And why would you say that has happened recently, in the last 10, 15?
Well, that was the question. Why did things seem to be more chaotic than they had been? And one answer that I came up with, I mean, just from reading more than from going to Somalia, was the collapse of an imperial balance that we had during the Cold War. In other words, the main two poles of global power were the capitalistic West and the communist Russian East, also China, but they were not so militaristic. The collapse of the Soviet Union lessened some of those tensions. There was a lot of sort of taut conflict also in Africa between those two powers. And some of that tension was holding up some of the governments in Africa. One of them was Somalia. The dictator in Somalia, Siad Barre, promptly fell in 1991, not long after the Berlin Wall fell. And that was all about the lack of sponsorship that he was. He was playing both sides for a long time, but the lack of sponsorship all of a sudden after the Cold War led to his demise. And that was a demise a lot like the fall of Muammar Gaddafi. He was holding the country together. Everybody hated him. And afterwards, anarchy. And so in that anarchy and in that vacuum, that sort of power vacuum created by the lack of a two bipolar world, after that, pirates arose. And that is really common throughout history. Also, there was a sort of low-burning pirate war across the Mediterranean for a long time between Europe and the Ottoman Empire. And when it was not a hot war, it was a warmish war on the water. And something very similar is going on right now with the Houthis in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, sometimes with the apparent cooperation of Somali pirates. So the phenomenon is coming up again, this time not for a lack of tension, but because Iran doesn't want its fingerprints on some of the attacks. So in other words, Iran has its... has this presence behind almost every belligerent in the current conflict, including the Houthis. So.
Yeah, and I think I definitely want to get into the current situation towards the end of this interview because it's intensely relevant. But it seems to me that Somalia, after the fall of the Cold War, becomes this sort of more, I guess you could say, geopolitically irrelevant country, right? It's a backwater. There's a famine. It's in really rough shape. It's fracturing into multiple states. And then just off its right coast, right on the east side of Somalia, is the most valuable shipping lane in global history. And for a country where fishermen are a major, part of just surviving the economy, it only takes a couple RPGs to turn a fisherman into a pirate. And
no, that's wrong. We'll talk about
that.
That's wrong. That's
all right. Good. I'm very glad. But the idea is that there is this lure of huge amounts of international capital coming off the coast. And all you need to do to grab that is to grab some of these vessels and then create some business model of, to get money out of those vessels, however it is that you might do it.
And
that puts us in that situation where we are. And why don't we go, so you're covering this story, you're going to write a book about it, you're doing your due diligence, you're talking to people who know a little bit about piracy, but you're going to be on the ground. And with all that preparation you did, what led to you actually being captured?
So we were we were guests of the Sa'ad clan in the center of Somalia. So the Sa'ad clan is sort of dominant in Galmudug. Galkayo is the capital of Galmudug, and our guide, a Somali elder that we met in Berlin, was actually friends with the president of the region. So we were officially guests of the Sa'ads, and these were Sa'ad elders who had invited us and were supposed to protect us. And in practice, what happened is that our guard team turned on us. Ashwin was also supposed to be kidnapped, and it was just luck that he wasn't. We went to the airport. We saw him get off. I saw him get onto the plane. He flew off to Mogadishu, and promptly after that, you know, almost as soon as I was alone, basically, driving back from the airport, I got kidnapped on land. And there was some controversy. There was a hot take in Slate shortly after that about whether Michael Scott Moore was really captured by pirates, because I was land by a bunch of guys with guns, right? Are these really pirates? Well, 3 months later, they put me on a ship that they had hijacked. So yeah, they were pirates.
What was that moment like? And so you had finished your reporting, it sounds like, and you were heading back.
We had done a lot of reporting. I still wanted to do a little more, but I had to wait several days anyway for a flight to Nairobi. Those weren't daily. So otherwise, I would have gotten on a plane, you know, that day to Nairobi. If there had been flights from that airport to Nairobi on that day, I would have taken one.
And what was the moment of actually being there? You know, how did you suddenly realize, oh, I'm being kidnapped? What was that?
Oh,
what
it
was
sucked. That like? No, I mean, and there was actually a moment of denial too. We were in the car. I mean, we had been there for 10 days, and we knew every day that there was a risk of this kind of thing happening. I mean, we had prepared with security and, you know, with our fixers. A sort of security plan so that we wouldn't get kidnapped. So we knew daily that it was going to be a problem. And on the way back from the airport, there was a technical, which is a battle wagon, sort of typical from the Somali Civil War, waiting by the side of the road. And our driver paused. He said, technical, you know, undetermined type. So in other words, we don't know whose it is. And this was all in German, my fixer was telling me. And I said, well, can we just go? And he said, it's one of ours. And then promptly, about 10 guys came off the flatbed of the technical with their Kalashnikovs, and they came over to my side of the car, and they pulled me out. And in those, 5 seconds, I thought, it's a traffic stop, right? It's okay. I've got my papers. I've got my German passport here. We'll just show these gentlemen my passport. And it was complete denial for about 3 seconds. Then they fired in the air. I'm like, fuck, I'm getting kidnapped. And my first thought was for my friends and family. I mean, I knew more about what was going on than I knew, you know, for example, my mother would. I knew that I was in trouble, but not, even though they beat me up on that afternoon, I was not going to die. I was not going to die that day anyway. But I knew that there was no way to explain all that to my family and friends. And I had no idea how long it was going to last.
So. Oh my God. That is just so terrifying. I mean, I think as journalists, a lot of us have been in similar situations, but they don't go south. Like, you know, you take risks as a reporter.
That's right.
Repeatedly. You know, I've been stopped by child soldiers with Kalashnikovs before. And, you know, you realize there's this tension in the air. It could go south. It could not.
You don't know what's going to happen with kids.
Right. Oh, right. No, you don't. You don't know what happens going to happen with kids. But then, you know, and then, you know, it's a risk that we know as reporters, but then it actually does go south and then it goes really south. Right. And what happens in the next few days for you?
They drove me out into the bush. It took about 3 hours. Somehow they knew where we were going, but we didn't follow like roads. We just sort of bounced over the bushes. Until there was a camp. I mean, obviously they were using GPS. We got to a camp and there were some more pirates. I mean, some more Somalis with guns. And by then my glasses were gone. So they had broken my glasses when they roughed me up. And so I was blind for the next 2.5 years, you know. So I could kind of tell that there were hostages at this camp, but I couldn't see them and I was bewildered. And I sat on this mattress that someone had laid out for me. I mean, it was waiting there for me, right? The whole thing was very well planned. And I sat down and somebody handed me a bottle of water and some bread, and that was it. I was a hostage, and I didn't meet the other hostages until the next morning when the pirates put us all in a car, they pulled up a car, and there were these two older men from the Seychelles, it turned out, who were fishermen who had been captured on the water. And they had been in that camp for about 3 months. One of them became my very good friend, Rolly Tambara, who becomes a character in the book, too. And Rolly said that they had come up on his boat at night while they were cleaning fish quite near the Seychelles, so 700 miles from Somalia. It took them a week to get there. And that was my first impression of other hostages in Somalia. I mean, I didn't meet another white person. You know, they were all other poor people that were being preyed on by the pirates. And so when you talk about a fisherman getting frustrated and taking up arms to defend their fishing grounds, that doesn't explain why pirates went 700 miles away from the Somali coast into international, if not Seychelles, waters, right, to pick up other people. It's organized crime. And so the roots of Somali piracy are illegal fishing and the defense of the coastline in the 90s. But by the time you and I heard about Somali pirates, it was a top-down, capitalist-financed criminal operation, a lot like the mafia, because a fisherman does not get his hands on an AK-47 or a rocket launcher without somebody paying for it for him. I mean, he doesn't just stop fishing because he's frustrated and poor and all of a sudden turn around and buy a fast skiff and some expensive weaponry. It doesn't happen like that. So I get extremely frustrated when I hear that story that they're just frustrated fishermen. It's not that simple. I go into the roots of it, the historical roots of it, where illegal fishing really is a problem, is a continuing problem. And stopping fishing boats was a measure against it. So there was some defense of the fishing grounds going on in the 90s. But that turned into Somali piracy, but that's not what Somali piracy was.
Sure. Yeah, I think that maybe I had misspoken. What I was saying is that, you know, you have an economy that had a lot of fishing in it. And yes. Then the idea of looking to take money out of the sea was right there. Certainly these people are criminals, right? And certainly you need weaponry and organization and
a lot of them are not even fishermen. So that's the thing. This came up in the trial. There was a trial of two pirates last year in New York. Two pirates in my case. And one of the defense lawyers said, well, these guys were just poor fishermen, right? And I had to lean into the microphone and say, absolutely not. No, they weren't. Most of the guys that I met were not fishermen, not even former fishermen. They were clan soldiers. To be a pirate, you need gun skills, right? One guy in a boat with six pirates, one guy needs to know how to run the outboard motor. That guy might be a fisherman. The other men need to know how to load and clean an AK-47. Those are clan soldiers. They might even be, you know, have a relationship to the Somali National Army, but generally a clan group of pirates or any group of pirates which are organized around clan lines draws from their young men who know how to load a Kalashnikov. And that means clan soldiers as opposed to fishermen. So land-based. I mean, a lot of these guys were from inland or from bush. They said, that's what they kept saying. That guy's from the bush. You know, they were snobbish to each other.
So, anyway. At one point, as I understand the story, and again, maybe my details are completely wrong here, but there was a rescue attempt by some sort of special forces on your camp. And the story that I remember is that two people were rescued and it was not you. Is that sort of in the ballpark of reality? And what story am I pulling out here?
It's in the ballpark. So I wasn't there. When I first heard about it, I wondered if they thought I was there because it seemed like a really bold move to do when there's another hostage nowhere near it. And it turned out to have a bad effect on my case. It was a bold move for Obama and the SEALs to pull, and it worked. I mean, it got Jessica Buchanan and another Norwegian NGO worker free from the pirates who had been holding them for about 3 months. I think it's possible that the military knew exactly where they were. They were accessible. They were sleeping out in the bush. Their defenses were probably low. And when I got captured, somebody just pulled the trigger on that mission and said, at the very least, we'll get these people, and then we'll deal with Michael Scott Moore.
Right. Well, because there's a lot of hostages being held, right?
There were a number of them. I mean, I think I got captured right around the peak of Somali piracy, and I think when I was still a free journalist, the number of seafarers, I mean, hostages of all types being held in Somalia was over 700.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was enormous, yeah.
Before we go on, there's two things that I want to talk to you about super quickly. The first is this video is a part of a passion project of mine, and I really, really need you to hit that like and subscribe button so that more people can see it. This is a tiny channel. It's completely self-funded, and as you can see by the wonky edits, it's sort of self-edited too. And I have this community on Patreon as well. And if you really want to, you know, make a difference in independent journalism, get early access to videos before they come out, go check that out. There are links down there in the description. All right, without any further ado, back to the interview.
And the thing about those hostages is, and I think it's really worthwhile to, you know, make this point over and over again, that a lot of them are just poor fishermen from the Seychelles, poor fishermen from Jordan, poor fishermen from other countries. And what are their lives worth on that international market?
Well, a lot less than the pirates thought, but their crews, including, you know, crewmen from India or Ukraine or Russia, of these massive ships, these massive cargo ships or tankers, have very international crews. The crew that I met, I mean, the boat that I got held on, anchored off Hobyo, was a fishing vessel. So it was one of these ships that the pirates were complaining about, because it was a longliner that could haul up, not a net. It didn't drag a net on the bottom. Those are the most destructive ones. But this was a longliner that could haul up, you know, tons of tuna per day. And if it were fishing in within Somali territorial waters, that would have been a crime. But they went out and got this ship fishing in international waters, also hundreds of miles from the Somali coast. So the guys involved in that, I mean, the guys caught up in that economy are very young, very poor Asian men who can't find good jobs at home and sign up for a ship like that. You know, they're not after, you know, valuable fish so much as they just want to do this work for a while and pay for their families at home. So it's a, you know, it's a very complicated and actually tragic situation.
Sure. And I've spoken to some of the ship owners, you know, people based in Copenhagen who wear ties and have glass offices, who are involved in these sorts of negotiations, like, far more frequently than they would have been.
Yeah.
And at least the ones that I've spoken to are very, very engaged in getting their crews safe. Like, they really, it's not like, hey, we got a brown person, we don't care about them. They actually do try to get their crew safe. But, you know, how hard is that? And what is what is their future and your future really look like? Because, you know, when I saw your hostage tape, which is a riveting, you know, sort of piece of video evidence out there of what happened. I mean, the threat is not only that they might kill you, but they might actually sell you to one of these, even, you know, not just a criminal gang, but a fundamentalist gang who has, you know, histories of beheading journalists on, you know, video camera. I mean, what can you tell me about that? I mean, you were very obviously scared at that moment.
I was scared. That video happened within months of my capture, but I was still held for another, you know, for a total of 2 years and 8 months. It was only towards the end of that captivity, first of all, that other Westerners were getting decapitated by ISIS. So ISIS arose in that time period in the Middle East. And I didn't think that I heard about James Foley getting killed the day after it happened, because at the time I had a little radio and I could listen to the news on the BBC over shortwave. So I heard about it very quickly, and the pirates were sort of electrified by it too. And they said, Michael, you know, don't worry about it. And I know, I'm like, yeah, I know pirates aren't going to try and chop my head off, but they might sell me to someone who would. And as it turned out, at that period, not when they made the video that you're thinking of, but at that period late in my captivity, there was a much higher chance that people sympathetic to ISIS involved in Al-Shabaab, which is normally aligned with Al-Qaeda, would have wanted a Western hostage to do that to. Before that, it would have been a more sort of practical arrangement. I mean, why would Al-Shabaab really pay that much money to the pirates for a Western hostage if they could get no political mileage out of it? They might get some, but that desire wasn't there until a number of people were decapitated on TV in 2014.
Well, certainly we have the case of Danny Pearl, which is far in advance of this, out of Afghanistan.
That had already happened, Pakistan. Yeah, in Pakistan. But I just don't think that, and that was Qaeda related, that's true. Not quite, but close to that related. It's true. So it wasn't, you know, off the radar when it happened, when the pirates made that video of me in May in 2012. But it was a much keener threat in 2014 once, you know, there was this, I guess, momentum of hostages getting killed in Syria. This is what I was told afterwards. I mean, in May 2012, I was scared enough. But apparently the calculation was different a couple of years later.
And what is you're known for having paid ransom to get out, right? This wasn't a special forces rescue.
How did
that negotiation proceed? And, you know, ultimately, you know, how did it, the bag drop or whatever? I don't know. How does that actually occur? And did the pirates win?
No, the pirates blinked. My mom negotiated. And my mom brought up set up a fund that a lot of people paid into. And then it was liquidated, turned into cash, and it was brought in a duffel bag. I don't know exactly who brought it, but I do know that before I was then brought to the plane in exchange, hours elapsed. So in other words, there were a few hours where the pirates decided they had to count all the money and run it through a machine counter. And then they claimed that they had to take me out of the bush and bring me into town to the airport, but that wasn't true. I was staying in a house in town, and it was a 20-minute car ride. I had to switch drivers a couple of times because you can't just put, you know, people who are basically close to the authorities right up against pirates. Somebody's going to, you know, get shot. So there had to be middlemen. And finally, I wound up, you know, in an SUV at the airport, and there was a plane waiting for me. And that was an incredible, it was an incredible relief, first of all, because during that period, I didn't know what was going on. The pirates kept telling me I was going to go free, but then it seemed like they were selling me to another group of Somalis, you know. And that day, I thought there was a very strong possibility I might get sold to Al-Shabaab. So it was a relief that I wasn't being.
I mean, it's an interesting conundrum, right? And this is what I was writing about in my Wired article back in 2011, I guess, when that came out. You need to you're dealing with criminals, but you need to have an element of trust with those criminals to make a handoff. And it's a conundrum for both the, you know, I don't know, the K&R, the kidnap and ransom company, if you worked with one of those, or, you know, whatever sort of institution on the good guy's side. But you also need trust on the bad guy's side, and you need to evaluate it. And I had run across a community, I don't know if you have a community, maybe it's a specialty of Somali hostage negotiators who work multiple cases. And the reason they're able to work multiple cases is because they have an element of trust and rapport that they've built with K&R companies, as if they're the guys who can actually, you know, they fulfill their promises. What do you know about those folks?
And well, those folks, I'm not so sure. I mean, I've certainly met a few of them, but the crucial thing is that the pirate gangs themselves have to stick to an agreement once they've made it. And those people you're talking about, the middlemen and the negotiators, have to know when they're serious about an offer or an agreement. Sometimes there's even a piece of paper that gets signed. I mean, as if it had any, you know, formal strength under any system of law. It doesn't. But once it gets to that step with a Somali pirate gang, the negotiators tend to know that they will try to keep their word because and within a gang, by the way, there are factions, so sometimes it falls apart. But as a rule, the pirates know that if they are found to be unpredictable and not trustworthy when it comes to agreeing to a final price, then the likelihood of an armed raid and an armed rescue goes up. Because if they can't be trusted as businessmen, which is how they think of themselves, and they really are only after money, right? They don't want to kill hostages as a rule. Then they realize that they can't even negotiate. I mean, they were extremely erratic at negotiators with my mom, but when it finally came down to it, if they weren't trustworthy and predictable about sticking to an agreement, then they would have had no business model. So the pirate gangs themselves knew that, and the middlemen you're talking about knew how to read that.
Yeah, I found this as a, you know, tangentially, I also have done a lot of work in like organ trafficking. That's sort of one of the things I'm known for.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and that idea around a rational business model with your criminals is like so important understand yeah. as somebody who's on the outside. They think that there's all the, you know, it's like, oh, you go kill someone and kidnap them. You kidnap them, you kill them, you take their kidneys and you sell it. But that's actually a terrible business model, because actually having the organ alive is super important. And also, you know, reducing your risk of getting caught by the cops later, a murder is a much bigger problem than a mutual agreement where you buy a kidney mm-hmm. for a low amount of money. And, right. And I find that this sort of understanding criminal activities as business gives you the lens to actually understand what's actually going on here. Because most people, even the, I mean, I can't speak to your exact case, but like I would say in general, the criminals are after money, and they can actually be even nice people, if you can put that couch that in some way where they just want to be good people, and they have a rationalization in their mind for why what they're doing is good and right as they go about it.
Well, I can't speak to organ trade, but it is true that pirates, even if they weren't, you know, frustrated fishermen, were poor. I mean, a lot of these guys who joined a pirate gang, especially at the sort of foot soldier level, wouldn't have done that if they'd had jobs. If the economy was working, and if you could found a business in Somalia without getting shaken down by Al-Shabaab or by some other criminal gang related to the pirates, as a matter of fact, then there would be less push to go and join a pirate gang and you know, grab some money. That's all that some of the guards were doing. You know, some of the guards I could tell didn't want to be mean to me. You know, you read people slowly as a hostage, but actually quickly as a hostage. But yes, there's a human element even. So this organ business, where have you studied it? In Libya or in?
Mostly in India, but India. International in general, but mostly India. But you know, the concepts are the same all around the world. You get a world-class hospital next to a really poor population, and presto mm-hmm. changeo, you have the ground terrain for an organ trafficking business, and it's rampant all around the world in various ways.
I did some work on the migrant trail between East Africa to Libya and then eventually to Europe while I was still in Europe after my captivity, because I realized that some pirates were switching business models over into that. And so I went to, I didn't go to Libya, but I went to Italy to talk about some of the people who had come through on that network. And in general, the Somalis are part of a Somali network and the Ethiopians are part of an Ethiopian network. And all that changes in Libya, but as far as getting there, they tend to go with their countrymen for language reasons and for other reasons. So it's an international network. And they said once they got, so I was talking to Somalis who had essentially been treated like hostages on the way to Libya and then in Libya even worse. And they said in Libya they had stories of organ, not donation, but you know, organ theft and the organ.
Sure. It can absolutely happen, but usually there has to be rational principles behind it. But yeah, I guess once you get on the trail of somebody whose life is worthless and they can vanish very easily, you have right. You can have ways to make it worse, and certainly with organ trafficking, you usually the first people who end up selling the organs are in refugee camps somewhere around the world. Like you have to go to the bottom, the most desperate, and the most vulnerable. It's all part of it. Now, one thing I want to go back to with you getting freed. I had said my last question was, did the pirates win? And you said no, the pirates blinked. What did you mean by that?
So they, of course, they won in the sense that they got money, but they had been, the original demand was $20 million, and they had been holding out for, I think, on the order of three before it went down to 1.6, or I guess 1.8 was the total that was paid, but I think 1.6 was the reported amount, and that's what wound up in my book, too, until I learned a little bit more, but... it was meant to be three until just like a week or so before I got out. So they blinked, you know, they accepted around half of what they were asking for at the very end in an effort to just end it and get me out. At that point, the guards were sick of it too. They were tired of holding me. And we had started to like each other, some of us. So,
what was the were you now? Were you officially on assignment with Der Spiegel or an American publication when you were there?
No, I had been on assignment from Der Spiegel when I was covering the court case. But I went down there to research a book with and some articles with a grant from the Pulitzer Center. The Pulitzer Center doesn't fund books, actually, but you know, the eventual goal was to write a book about the trial and the deep background of the trial. Five of the 10 guys were from Galkayo, which is the main town we went to, and the whole thing seemed to come together very well because our elder knew that area and everything. So our fixer, the elder in Berlin, and so he, you know, made it seem very possible to write a deep, well-reported book about an incident that Americans didn't know about. It was really close to Captain Phillips. I mean, this German ship got attacked by pirates, and what didn't happen is that, you know, the captain floated off in a very small boat and had to be rescued by snipers. That didn't happen, but they did get rescued by the Dutch Navy, who then arrested these 10 guys and brought them to Germany. So it was another example of, and a European example of that Captain Phillips story. And I thought it would make a really interesting book with some deep background.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you, so there was no other institution that was on the hook trying to negotiate. The Pulitzer Center didn't come in and say, okay, we have some responsibility here.
The Pulitzer Center would have been, I mean, I wanted to call them first when I got captured. I mean, they knew it was going to be dangerous too. Yes, they did help, as a matter of fact. The Spiegel also did more than they had to as an institution. But it would have been the Pulitzer Center. I mean, that was the institutional backing I had. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've often felt as a freelancer, you know, I'm in these situations and I don't have... you're a freelance journalist and you sort of have a contract, you have an informal handshake with some editor over like the New York Times or Wired and you're there and you're sort of on your own. Like my experience has been oftentimes like if shit goes down, I'm just dead. Like there's no, I don't really see the Navy coming in to save me. I just see it's like you have to be a little almost sadly suicidal to be a freelance journalist doing this sort of stuff. And that's not, any romantic way whatsoever. It's just frankly awful.
Well, that was on my mind while I was there because my father committed suicide. So I had not quite been confronted with that idea until I was a hostage. All of a sudden I was like, well, so why am I doing this again? you know, what exactly brought me here? So there's some reflection on that in the book. The institutional backing was, I mean, I did feel pretty good about the people who were behind me. I mean, a lot of people knew I was going, and I had some pretty good support. But one thing you just said about the Navy coming in to get hostages, I didn't think that would happen at all. The only thing that changed my mind was that sudden rescue of Jessica Buchanan 4 days and Paul Thisted 4 days after I got captured. So I learned about that through the pirates. And I thought, oh my gosh, so now Americans really do want to put boots on the ground in Somalia. That was the first time since Black Hawk Down that U.S. forces had done something so bold, apart from a couple of al-Shabaab assassinations. So there was some shit going down. But I did not think that an American president would risk something like that for, you know, a civilian. And for me. Certainly not for me. And so all of a sudden, another American civilian got rescued by SEALs. And I thought, oh my gosh, well, now maybe it won't happen because the SEALs have already done it, right? Lightning doesn't strike twice. On the other hand, maybe it will because it just did. So all of a sudden, it was part of the calculation once I was a hostage. But before I went, I honestly did not think that something like that would happen. Militarily.
And did it make it more dangerous for you to have even the possibility of SEALs coming in and doing that? Or is it better to keep it as a business situation?
It's a very good question. At some point, it had been so long that I was a hostage that I thought it was just a coin flip whether I was going to get out or not. Whether I was going to live was a total coin flip, partly because even if SEALs came in, like best case scenario, someone comes in and rescues you. If that happens, even then it's 50% that the hostage dies, right? I mean, these are very rough numbers. I don't know the actual statistics. But one of the most dangerous things you can do is send in the SEALs. But on the other hand, that's what special forces groups were first invented for. I mean, we have special forces in the United States partly because of a number of hostage cases in the 1970s. They grew out of other special forces groups. But the ones that we have now are specially trained for that kind of thing. Nevertheless, it's really dangerous, especially for the hostage, because of course the hostage takers are like, well, we'll just shoot this person if you come and, you know, challenge us. So, of course, the pirates said that to me very early on. They said, well, if you try whatever you did with Jessica Buchanan, we'll kill Michael. Tell them that on the phone. I'm like, well, yeah, but that's the circumstance of hostage life anyway. I mean, that was already... Those were the rules as soon as you caught me.
Right.
So that was nothing new to me.
Right. You knew at any time this could go that direction because you're pointing the gun at me already. Like, what are you going
exactly.
to add to
this
threat? So what has happened to the other people who were with you in captivity on that boat? You know, for instance, Raleigh, who is a major character in your book, what is their story today?
So Raleigh went back to the Seychelles and really had a lovely retirement. Actually, he continued to fish, but you know, he didn't have to. And he died a year and a half ago, but you know, essentially of old age. I went to see him twice. I got to know his family. It was really a lovely sort of story. And his friend Mark, who lived up the road, is still alive, as far as I know. And they both had a perfectly good retirement afterwards. The guys from the fishing boat, mostly young men from Southeast Asia, as well as China, are back at their lives. And I've only visited three guys in Cambodia. I would like to see some more and actually do that for a book. It's as mixed as any group of 28 people, I imagine. Some are doing quite well, some are struggling. Everybody, you know, everybody was poor to begin with. So they came back to opportunities that were sort of up and down. Nobody except, there were a couple of like hardcore fishermen who have gone back to fishing. I know one guy from Taiwan who's on ships all the time because I see him on social media. So he puts videos and photos from ships up on Instagram. Everybody else, like everybody in Cambodia, for example, they're staying far away from the sea. They're doing road work.
Now, were they,
you know.
Were they also freed through ransom negotiations, or how did they get free?
2 years later, but yeah, they had ransom negotiations that eventually led to a deal. It was run by the UNODC, so a UN group that, not just UNODC, but a group that developed under UNODC and then shaved off, but whatever. And they existed really for seafarers who had been forgotten essentially by their countries. I don't think the Cambodian government did very much, for example. But so their job was to gather some money together and negotiate and say, look, these guys really don't have very much money or support behind them at all, and you can't expect very much. And in the end, they were held, they almost set a record for the length of time they were held. I think there was only one other group of seafarers that was held longer than this group from the Naham 3, from the ship I was on. And it was on the order of 5 years. I think the longest was over 5 years, and these guys were held for just under 5 years. It's brutal. I mean, and two people died, right? I mean, when I say that Somali pirates don't want to kill people, some hostages just die of neglect, right? Or because the pirates can't aim with their guns. So...
and you lost something like 40 pounds in the first few months. I mean,
this 40 pounds, yeah. Yeah, and I knew that because once I was on the ship, there was a scale. There was a tuna scale, and we could weigh ourselves. Yeah.
Wow. So what do we think? So, you know, I always have this trouble with these sorts of problems that to free you, the safest way to do it is to pay the ransom. On the other hand, when you pay the ransom, you give the incentive to the bad guys to keep on doing piracy because now there's a financial business model in it. And, you know, there's that old term, the phrase, we don't negotiate with terrorists because you negotiate with terrorists, you incentivize terrorism. And there's also, you know, through Hiscox and other insurance companies, or even insurance for kidnap and ransom with their own teams of negotiators to rescue crews or at least negotiate with crews. How do we think about this situation in a rational way? Like, you know, part of me says, well, we should never, ever rescue hostages or ever give any money to them. And that's the best way to stop hostage taking. On the other hand, if I was taken hostage, I'd want a way to get out. So how do we think about this?
Well, I thought about that a lot while I was a hostage. First of all, every case is different. So making a blanket statement like that just doesn't work. You can't say what we will always do is send in the SEALs, partly because there are only a few countries in the world that have special forces like that who can achieve something like that, maybe four. And the other thing is that not every case can be resolved. I mean, to me, the moral thing is certainly to send in a group of operators and take the hostage alive. Yeah, for sure. And not send money to the extortionists. Because that does, at the very least, it helps the criminal organization thrive, right? It injects an enormous amount of money into the pirate network. And one effect of that, by the way, is to make them less desperate to make a deal for other groups of hostages. And that happened in my case. So in other words, one group of seafarers got released around the time that there was an attempt to get me out by one sort of freelance former Navy SEAL. Not with violence. He had, you know, made what seemed to be a proper deal. And he landed and he noticed that other hostages were getting out. And he said, oh, the pirate network is now going to be sort of flooded with money. Something might go wrong. And it did. You know, they asked him for more money from me. And he had to go home. So it's bad in all sorts of ways when you give money to a criminal gang like this. I don't think that's moral. On the other hand, every hostage case is different, and to get a hostage home alive and healthy, sometimes that's the way. And it's a political leader's job. It's the job of a number of decision makers to figure out which one is best, right? I was prepared. If it was going to come down to violence, I mean, I was prepared to lose my life. I knew that I had gotten myself into this situation, so it wasn't like I was, and I knew that I was waiting around a long time because negotiations were taking so long, because they had started at such a high level, $20 million. So I knew that I had gotten myself into that. So it's not like I was sitting around desperate for someone to move heaven and earth just to save my behind. I knew that there were some very good chances that I might be there for a long time or that I might get killed in the effort to get me out. So in retrospect, I don't think that there are blanket policies or blanket things that you can say to solve the hostage problem once someone's been taken, because every case is different.
Definitely. So I think the last question I'd really want to dig into is, how do we connect what happened to you, the Somali piracy situation, to what is happening right now with the Houthis in, right now we're in the conflict in Palestine has now expanded into, shutting down the Suez Canal to some degree, at least redirecting a large amount of traffic around the southern, around Africa. How do these two conflicts talk to each other?
So first of all, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza did not spread by accident. So the Houthis are not just doing this out of the goodness of their hearts or out of some idealistic feeling for their Palestinian brothers. That's what they say, obviously, and that's what a lot of people believe. But of course, it's more tactical than that. And their ship approaches in the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea are a lot like Iranian Revolutionary Guard ship approaches in other parts of the region, in the Persian Gulf and that sort of thing. It's the same pattern. It's the same tactics. And it is with Iran behind it. I mean, the Houthis would not be doing it if they didn't have these weapons from Iran. Hamas is backed by Iran. Hezbollah is backed by Iran. The militias in Iraq and Syria that are attacking Israeli and Western bases, also in Jordan, are backed by Iran. All of it has Iran behind it. There's something more strategic going on. The important thing is not to fall for it, from my point of view. I mean, I don't see how Israel's war is really going to improve things. Because they've already tried it four times, with demolishing Gaza, and I'm not so sure that the fifth war is going to do it. But there is something beyond the headlines that's going on, and I think that the West is getting baited into a regional war, but I don't know why. The Houthis are certainly trying to harass shipping. I think they'll probably stop if the Gaza war stops, but they're trying to make it very, very difficult for Israel in the West. And the reason is what's, escaping me. It's not just love for Palestinians in Gaza.
It strikes me as when we talk about piracy, right? When we think about piracy, we think about the old piracy. We're talking, Sir Francis Drake time period, with the privateers funded by England, there was the pirates were, especially for Sir Francis Drake, who was a pirate, he was essentially a proxy war figure in and accomplish other political aims. And it seems that we're seeing, with that entire region, we're seeing the opportunity of people locally, such as these warlord figures who are like, now our personal interests can be funded by another party, and why not take that? Why not take that? And they probably don't even know how they fit into the larger plan.
Depends, but I do think that the proxy warfare that's going on among these groups that are backed by Iran is absolutely in Iran's interest. So the reason for it probably is to keep Iran from getting somehow sidelined in the Middle East and make sure that it maintains a certain amount of influence. And certainly Hamas attack to keep from being sidelined by normalization with the Saudis and that kind of thing. I mean, everyone wants Hamas to go away, and Hamas doesn't want to go away. So that was the reason for the, kicking off the hostilities in the first place. Of course, the whole thing benefits Iran and other powers in some interesting ways, but the Houthis are absolutely being used as proxies in war, just like pirates were, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago. Absolutely. And they may have a relationship to the Somalis. I think the Somali piracy that's been going on in the meantime has been opportunistic. You know, all of a sudden, the Navy ships that are were normally there in the region to stabilize and keep Somali piracy tamped down are distracted. So the pirates can do more. But, you know, they're not far from each other. Somalia is right across the water from Yemen. So it wouldn't surprise me if there were some sort of relationship. Like you said, it's proxy warfare, and piracy has a long history of being that. But it's also chaos. I mean, the chaos is also helpful to someone. So.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, on the day we're recording this, you know, I think it was last night, or maybe it was 2 days ago, three American servicemen were killed in this broader conflict, and 30 supposedly injured. All the details are not in. By the time people watch this, we will know the details. But it could be the beginning of a bigger conflagration, as we see. You know, when American service personnel die in that region, there's two things that we do. We either Black Hawk down and disappear, because that's what we did after Black Hawk down. We pulled out of Somalia. Or it turns into something which is much, much worse.
Yeah. And that it would be an absolute tragedy for it to go that way. It's an absolute tragedy what's happening in Gaza. And, you know, I've been to Gaza and I've been to Israel, and I know that the people who want war on both sides are two sides of the triangle. And there's a third side of the triangle that consists of people in both places, maybe fewer now, but on both sides of the Gaza border who actually wanted peace. And a lot of them were in those kibbutzes on October 7th, by the way. And it's those people who actually want to live side by side and who want peace in spite of everything that's happened, who need the power. It's those people who don't have the power.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. Let's, you know, so we don't give away everything in your book and the future projects that it sounds like you're working on. Where do people find more out about you? Tell me the title of the book again, and let's direct some people to your amazing work.
The book is called The Desert and the Sea. It's a memoir of my captivity. I've also written a book called Sweetness and Blood, which is about the history of surfing, but also the politics of surfing. I've written a novel. I'm working on another novel. You can learn about all of it at radiofreemike.net, which is my website. And I've got a Twitter feed and an Instagram feed and that sort of thing.
Great. Thanks so much. I really appreciate you being here, you know, from Poke Bear LLC, currently in Mexico City. This was Magnetic North.